Hey, Tara Strong here, and you're listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo. Joining me today for a special 200th episode is Comic Concierge Dan. Hello.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I changed my name for 200. So, you
know. I wanted to throw people off. So yeah. Today we're going to break away from our Turtles talk for a minute. We've been covering all of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies, whether it be live action or animated. As we've been going through that, we have one left plus the new release this year of the Turtles to still cover. So we'll come back and cover those in our next two episodes. But today, since it's episode 200, we thought we should do something special. And way back when, in 2019/2020, we were covering a whole bunch of lists about the best of the previous decade. That would be the 2010 to 2019 decade. And we did things like the top 10 action films and the top 10 superhero films and all kinds of different genres, but we never got to our actual just overall film list. So this is a good opportunity for us to cover that. So Dan, we're going to be covering our top 10 films of the past decade. And do you have any opening thoughts or kind of things that you were thinking about as you made your list? Was it easy? Was it hard?
Oh, it was really hard, I think, because you're talking about, you know, hundreds of movies a year to 10 films is really difficult. Like, I definitely felt like I knew what my top five was. I actually made this list years ago when we first started doing it. And then I'm like, I'm going to go in blind and see how familiar, like how similar they are, you know, compared to what I did like 2 years ago. And the movies I thought would stay the same, but there were changes. So it is an ever changing list, but yeah, it is challenging to narrow it down. Cause you're like, okay, well, there's this has to be my top 10. This has to be there. And then you're like, okay, that's 20 films and not how numbers work. So we got to figure out something.
Yeah, I had like some that were for sure no doubters. Like I knew in my mind, there's no chance they're not going to be on the list. And that covered probably at least a good half of it. And then I had another half that came fairly easy. And then I had like number 10. And I was like, how do I fit 10 films into this 10th spot? So there was a lot of things that I wanted to make it. And I'm like, oh, I only have one spot left. And that's a problem. So I waffled back and forth on the top 10. I also had done this originally way back when we did it, you know, a few years back when we were starting this whole project of all the different genre films. And I also went back and looked at it and I changed one as far as like one specifically. Some stuff moved up and down, but like I changed one that was on the list that's not on anymore and I inserted something else on it. So some minor changes, but I think it'll be interesting to go in. I'm kind of excited to hear some of your picks. I know, you know, just doing all the podcasts together that we've done over the years, and you know, there was a certain time during that 10-year section where you and I especially were covering a lot of films together. So I do have a feeling that I'll have some predictions for what you have on your list that I might have as well, but it'll be interesting to see all the other ones as well. So why don't you kick us off and give us your number 10?
So number 10, of course, I think is always the hardest because it's like, you know, the last one. So it's like trying to determine what should go here. And I had like four different responses. I went with a few things, but I ultimately went with Blue Ruin. In large part because it was one of the best blind watches I ever had in that past decade. I ended up watching it with not knowing much about it. It was like, it just appeared on demand one day. Poster looked interesting. Concept seemed interesting. And watched it. And I was like, wow, this is really quite good. And I think it's actually really beneficial to watch that movie knowing nothing about it. Because it opens up like a very different movie than it ends up being. It opens up with this bearded homeless guy who's kind of like traversing the world. I'm like, okay, I'm settling in for like this picture about individual just like coming to terms with who he is as a person or something like that, something more introspective. And then it ends up actually being kind of a deconstruction of the revenge genre in a rather effective manner. Obviously directed by Jean-Marie Saunier, Malcolm Blair's in this, and this, they've done a lot of great stuff in the past decade. And I just love so much about it, like how it kind of took a lot of those tropes we often see and just tweaked them a bit and made them, I don't want to say like too realistic, but at least kind of turned them on their head. Like even small things like the difficulty of cutting open a tire and how like that's so much harder than it seems. and to, you know, someone trying to do self-surgery that we always see in those movies and always goes swimmingly and not go there. So plus it had, you know, the big brother from Home Alone, you know, the Home Alone movies as well. You know, he showed up for a bit. Right. And he was great. So there's just a lot about this movie I really loved. I actually did an article last year, 2 years ago, comparing this to another comic called Kill to Be Killed, because both of them look at like individuals that are not, are like taking on vengeance in their own hands that are way over their head. And there's a lot of similarities between both of them, but they go about it different ways. There's all also like an underlying message regarding the aspect of gun control and ones that what that means, because that's a big part of this as well, as in like trying to find a gun to actually, you know, murder the people that hurt his parents or, you know, what have you, him going back, getting news. But, you know, it's a great film. Like I said, a big part because I went in with so zero expectations. It made me fans of pretty much everyone in that movie for life, and anything they do, I've been able to enjoy. You know, Green Room was a movie I also thought about, but I went with The Ruin mostly because, like, you know, it's that surprise. It's really hard to for that to happen, and when it does, it's, you know, it's hard to forget. So it was my number 10.
Yeah, I like that one quite a bit too. I've only seen it once, but I do remember enjoying it, and I enjoyed also the fact that it just has like this unique feel to it. It's not this like polished studio like genre film or anything like that. It's like this like quirky, you know, take on this, and it's so, like you said, you mentioned a bunch of the things, but it peels the curtain back on things that we just, some of us probably assume like those are how things happen in real life just because we've seen it in movies like 1,000 times, like you talked about with the tire, etc. And there's just all these other things that it's like, oh, this movie's so real, like I can relate to this because it's not, you know, they're not all superheroes in this movie. They're not all doing these things that human beings can't do, or, you know, different stuff like that. So there's just a realness to this film that I really appreciated.
Yeah, there's a lot of silence too. There's a lot of just scenes with no dialogue whatsoever, like setting up with the climax. You see him just going through, like he's trying to hunt down this family, and you just kind of see him going through and determining like, what is he supposed to do? You see him questioning himself. Yeah, it definitely is a movie that I think, you know, was definitely done on a smaller budget, but considering its confines, really overachieved.
Yeah. I'm going to go from that movie that enjoys quiet times and a realism to about the most polar opposite that we can possibly go to with my number 10. I'm going to go with what was also considered probably the best action film of the decade by many people. It was not on my top 10 original list, but I made it in here when I was fine tuning it here. So I'm going to go with Mad Max Fury Road here from George Miller from 2015. I know a lot of people could make a case for John Wick, but I think Mad Max Fury Road is just better in multiple different levels across the board. But it's definitely bombastic. It's definitely like crazy unreal as far as some of the stuff that's happening, but it's just stuff that is just fun to see on the big screen. It all works together, and it was something that like I had no idea what to expect going into this after all the other Mad Maxes that had come out, you know, in the 80s and things like that were super cheesy. Like we got, you know, Tina Turner singing songs for us and the Thunderdome and all this kind of craziness. And it was like, how is this going to translate? You know, that fit in the 80s, but how is this going to translate to 2015 when Mad Max Fury Road came on? And it was just amazing. Like just a visual spectacle, an experience that like defines what you want when you go to see a blockbuster. And I think it also did something too. I kind of tried to make some notes on some of these films that made my top 10 as far as some of the bigger messages or bigger impacts or influences, like what the decade stood for in film, in my opinion, I guess. And for this one, I think there was really a movement to give us more strong females in film, not just action films, but just more strong female roles. Obviously there's still a long way to go in the male female balance, etc., as far as that goes, but I think obviously Furiosa was a major statement there in 2015, and we've seen a lot since then where more females have gotten those major roles, and so, especially in action films, but across the board. So I just think Mad Max Fury Road is, there's not much bad to say about it, so I couldn't figure out a reason why I would keep it out of my top 10, so I'm going to put it in my 10 spot.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to add more to that. Mad Max is a great movie. It's not my top 10, not because it's not a good movie, but it's definitely impressive just what George Miller is able to do with that, like you talked about practical effects, and it certainly kind of showed just the limits of what can happen when you have no limits, which you do wonder sometimes, like, there had to be like zero safety regulations sometimes with some of those things that they were doing. But yeah, it was the definition of a throw at. I was really hoping when it came out that year that it was going to sneak in and maybe get a Bad Picture nomination, because that would have been amazing. I know it had no shot, but it did, you know, did get a few Oscars, including Best Editing and stuff like that. But yeah, hard to argue with the stunt work in that, incredible. But you mentioned like how you're looking for things that define the decade. And when it comes to defining the decade, superhero films certainly did it within the box office. You know, easily the year, the decade of the superheroes, even though we had them beforehand, hit a new threshold, I think, in that decade, especially with the MCU expanding and, you know, getting all the Infinity War Avengers movies. And I do have a Marvel movie on my list, although it's not an MCU film. It is an animated film, and I think it's in the argument of one of the greatest superhero films of all time, and that is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I didn't feel like it would be wrong to not include any superhero films, considering how much they did define the decade. And there's a lot that I enjoy, Logan, Civil War. I think all those, you know, even if they are popcorn entertainment, when it looks at overall quality with the genre, they're there. But Into the Spider-Verse does so much. I've watched this movie many times because my kids enjoy it. So I've seen it probably the most of any movie on this list. And it still holds up every time. We also obviously got the sequel this year. I can't say which one's better because I've only saw that movie once compared to this. Also great soundtrack. And I think, you know, what it did was just not only for superhero genre, but the animated genre, because with animation, we've had a lot of great animated films, but when it comes to popular animation, there is just a staleness to design. Like everything kind of looked like Pixar for a while. And then here comes Into the Spider-Verse and completely changes that. It looks completely different. It does some interesting things within like how it handles Miles Morales and like frame rate, how, you know, it just looks and incorporates so much of the language of comics into the actual movie itself. And of course it has all the craziness, including a talking pig and whatnot and Nick Cage. But that stuff to me is just extra. But what it really got right was Miles Morales, his story, his family story, his struggles. And, you know, there's something universal about that. And I think mostly because of the authenticity it added, I think even better compared to a lot of the comics. So it, you know, it kind of, I don't say came out of nowhere, but I think it was this small animated film that, you know, people had interest in, but I think it blew everyone away, and how now it's become this franchise. And, you know, definitely an argument of one of the greatest animated films of the decade. And I think, you know, I think it defined what superhero films could be as well. So that's why it's my number 9.
Yeah, I've only seen this one time, so I definitely need to revisit it because I just haven't seen it enough to like form great opinions on it either way. I mean, I know it's universally loved, and I haven't heard hardly any bad things about it. I think what's interesting, you bring up a point as far as the animation style and the difference that, you know, kind of gave us a new look and something different. It wasn't like the classic Disney animation look. It wasn't like the Pixar animation look that we... And it's interesting to me that animation, when it comes to movies, and animation when it comes to cartoons or animated series that are on TV or streaming, etc., how different it is. Because in animated films, we get the same type of animation over and over and over again, it seems like, mainly because they're coming from the same studios, but then everybody else kind of just jumps on board with that, I guess, as well. But then when you go to like animated cartoons or things that are on TV, there is so many different styles out there. There's so many different looks and differences in the way they're animating, that it's weird that more hasn't translated to the big screen like we saw with Into the Spider-Verse. So I don't know if that's just something that they're just afraid to do when it comes to actual feature-length films or what, and they're just more adventurous when it comes to cartoons, I guess. But Into the Spider-Verse, I think what you said, a lot of people hold that as one of the best superhero films of the decade, one of the best animated films of the decade, so it makes total sense. I can understand why it's here. So for my number 9, there's going to be one thing that probably comes up a couple times on my list, a little bit heavier topic maybe, but the movie that I'm going to be talking about at 9 does it in a way that it doesn't seem as heavy. But I think the last decade and even on into this current decade, you know, we've seen a whole lot of issues revolving around race, race relations, and things of that nature. You know, it's not something that we've solved like a lot of people throughout the 90s seemed like they thought we had. I don't know why, but it's something that just definitely came to the forefront, I think, in that decade. And so I'm going to have a couple of films on my list that deal with that. But the first one here that I'm putting in at number 9 is from Spike Lee, and that's Black Klansman from 2018. I don't know if it's just my love for the Washington family, like I, as far as seeing them act on stage, but John David Washington in this was just like a revelation to me. And the way that he exudes his father's acting style and cadence and things like that, like speaking cadence and stuff like that from Denzel is just incredible. Adam Driver's in this, a couple other people obviously of note, but I think what this one does interestingly is that it does this, you know, heavy topic like race relations and the Ku Klux Klan, etc. And then it adds like this completely almost ridiculous comedic like element to it. So it doesn't feel heavy, but it still is eye-opening. It's still like something that is important, like that can, I don't know, like wake people up, maybe. I'm not going to say most of our country can't be woken up, it seems like, but it's like it does it in a way that it's not just like bashing you over the head to me. It's like this most preposterous thing where this, you know, African-American person is in the KKK, et cetera, and so it leads to all these like somewhat on surface comedic things, but it's like also under this huge undertone of like a super important thing that we're needing to still deal with. So I just thought Spike Lee did a great job with this. I thought John David Washington acted perfect in this, and this was one of my favorite films of 2018. And it just kind of stuck with me. I haven't literally rewatched it a bunch of times or anything like that, but it just has been something that's stuck with me as far as things that I think about and staying power as far as that goes. Another great decade, too, for Adam Driver, and obviously he's in this as well. So one of his many films that you could highlight on a list like this. So Black Klansman is my number 9.
Yeah, not on my list, but definitely love that movie. It's really, it seemed like it was, you know, Spike Lee, he was making some good movies, but occasionally he'll come out with a great one, and that was certainly, I think, Black Klansman. I think it helps when he has the subject matter for it. And he, you know, love Spike Lee because, like, he does not hold back when it comes to what he's trying to say. Subtlety is not, you know, his forte, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. But it's interesting you mentioned Adam Driver being in your pick. Adam Driver's also in my next pick, although not a huge part, only in one scene, but it's one of the best scenes of the movie. 8, I have Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen Brothers, which I always see, like, generally it seems like people often are down on this when it, for some people, are for the overall Coen Brothers filmography, but I really enjoy this movie a great deal. Although I don't know if enjoy is the right word, because it is a bit of a downer. And I think in the forefront of that is Oscar Isaac. I saw him a few other things, but this is where like I became a huge fan of him. Like his performance in this, from the opening scene, talking about soundtracks. I've listened to soundtracks so much, and I'm not a huge like folk singer person, but this made me into one. But just the emotion that he has throughout this entire movie. You know, he plays a really intriguing character who's not very likable. And you know, he's super talented, but just can't catch a break. And I think with a lot of times with Coen Brother movies, you don't necessarily always appreciate them until you've watched them a few times. This one I loved the first time, but I've enjoyed it more on rewatches as well. And just the story it's telling, and just packed with great performances. Some humorous moments as well, mentioning Adam Driver, that scene with him and Justin Timberlake kind of doing the outer space one. Hilarious, and like it's a scene that necessarily like doesn't really forward the plot all that much. It's not necessarily a movie about plot. It's, you know, it's very much a character piece, which is always what the Coen brothers do. You think something about Fargo, which is pretty intricate when it comes to its storytelling. But this, it doesn't really, you know, it's not in a hurry really to go anywhere. It's taking its time. It's kind of just finding itself along the way, which is, I think, fitting for a song about a folk singer. So I don't know. I love this movie, and I don't know if you look at Prestige, it maybe deserves a top 10, but for me, it was just going based upon how I feel and movies that have impacted me, and because this is one that not only impacted me with watching the film, but listening to the soundtrack and It's just one of the, it's one that I think about a lot. So I have it at number 8.
Yeah. I think this is definitely worthy of being in this discussion for sure. And to talk about another actor that had a decade for themselves, Oscar Isaac was definitely a good decade for him when this came out. And I haven't revisited Inside Llewyn Davis. This could be a broken record because I actually like looked at my top 10. I don't know if I've revisited any of my top 10 either. Like I just, it's hard for me to rewatch films because I have to justify the fact that I'm not going to watch something I haven't seen before. So it's just like a hard thing for me personally to do.
Yeah.
So I could say that to almost all of my films. So most of this is just on that initial impact or, you know, that initial watch or just how much it stayed with me after the fact. But I did enjoy Inside Llewyn Davis. I think it's a great Coen Brothers film. Maybe you have heard more people that rank, you know, filmographies and things like that, but I haven't heard anybody say anything bad about Inside Llewyn Davis, but I guess I don't listen to as many people that are just like breaking down the whole filmography.
I just remember at the time there was a lot of people who loved it, but there was some people that were detractors of it. I think in large part because it's not a very flashy movie. In fact, like its color palette is pretty dull, I think purposely so. You know, it takes place in 1961, but you really can't tell because it doesn't really wear its decade on its sleeve, which I think I prefer because it gives it more of a timeless quality. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who love it, but I know there's with Coen Brothers. It wasn't as hated as like Hail Caesar, which is another Coen Brothers movie I really enjoyed. So maybe I'm just a sucker for what they do. There are movies they've done I don't like, but yeah. Sure. So. What's your number 8?
My number 8, I'm going to go to a film that I was not expecting to like as much as I did. This one's from 2014. It's from Damien Chazelle, and this is Whiplash. It was my number 1 film of the year that it came out, and it has pretty much stayed that way. I don't have any other films from 2014 on my list at all. And I think this one, number 1, is just seems like it's brilliantly constructed, like it's brilliantly acted, directed, written, etc. So like it seems like it has all of the like fundamentals, it has all the structure pieces, you know, it has all of the what a movie needs to be good type stuff. But then I don't know, it has this undertone of like this quest for success that, or not necessarily a quest for fame, but quest for success, like just how much we can become obsessed with certain things, what we're willing to do to achieve whatever it is that we are becoming so over, not just passionate about, but I think obsessed with. And I just think this movie worked for me for reasons I don't even know. I mean, I was in music and band and stuff like that for over a decade. So like I was never on like any type of level, you know, like that was that great, but so I kind of get it, but I don't know, it just worked for me. And this is another one where Miles Teller, I think, just does a great performance. J.K. Simmons is fantastic in this. And I don't know, I can't really explain why it worked for me as much as it did, because if you just told me the plot and kind of explained like the story of what this was going to be about, I would be like, that seems like it might be a fairly boring a couple hours for me, but I just did not find it that way at all. So Whiplash really worked for me. I can't really explain why, but it stuck with me ever since then. So I'm going to keep it here at my number 8.
Yeah. I think Whiplash is one of those movies, like if you watch it and you don't like it, I feel like, why, how do you, I just feel bad. But yeah, I can get it. Cause like J.K. Simmons is so intimidating that like you could like just feel uncomfortable. So maybe that's why, but yeah, Whiplash is so good. I was hard not putting that in my top 10, but you know, again,
I'll say I like that one. I like that one from Damien Chazelle a lot more than the one I watched of his today. So he came out with a movie. I don't know if it's technically last year, but I think some people consider it this year. I don't know, that Babylon film.
Oh yeah. I've not watched that yet. So
That is a long 3 hours to get through, and don't watch it around any parents, kids, or anybody that you'd be embarrassed about watching crazy shenanigans. All right. What's your next one?
So my number 7, very different than anything we've been talking about. I am going back to the world of animation, and I'm going with a Studio Ghibli film, although you may not be able to tell that just based upon when you look at the poster, because it's not like your typical Studio Ghibli film. It's not directed by Hayao Miyazaki. It is The Red Turtle. And it's a really simple story. I gotta give, maybe that's what I love. I love simplicity. But it's just, you know, this individual living on an island. And what I love about, I love movies that kind of take something away and have limitations, and either if it's budget with something like Blue Ruin or with The Red Turtle, where there's no dialogue whatsoever. Like, how do you tell a story where you have no dialogue? Not even like with a silent film where you have title cards. You got to just rely on your storytelling when it comes to animation, which is not an easy thing to do. It's hoping that the audience can really understand what you're trying to portray, especially when you're dealing with actual animals in some instances and things like that. But I found this movie to be brilliant, loving. It's emotionally impactful throughout, especially near the end. But it's just it's a beautiful film as well, like animation wise. It's an interesting clashing of, you know, you have it obviously being produced within Studio Ghibli, but the style is much more European. It looks rather unique, again, compared to really even anything else out there. You know, it has the kind of like the smoothness of you would something with like, you know, computer animation, but it has a hand-drawn quality as well. So it looks like no other animated film. And what's great about it is legitimately universal, because, you know, there's no dialogue to be no subtitles or anything like that, even though it's coming from another country, because there's no words. And I just, something like that always impresses me. Like, just being able to do that at a sufficient level, let alone at quite the level that this does it. So I didn't have it as my best animated film. I think I had Inside Out. But as I went back and just looked at, again, the thing that came to my mind was how much these movies impacted me. And this was near the top of the list. So I have it here.
I like it. I like the animation representation that you have so far. I wanted to have some, and I wanted to fit Kubo and the Two Strings in my list somewhere, and I just couldn't quite do it. So I like the animation spotlight that a couple of years have done. So that's awesome. For my next one, some of these are going to be super boring for me to talk about, I think, because it's just like stuff that has been already well talked about by a lot of people. It's, you know, they've had acclaim, they've had awards and things like that. And so I apologize if some of this is going to be a little bit boring. I'm taking some of the easy picks, I guess. But my number seven, I think sexuality is something that has been a major theme of the last of that decade. And I don't know if a film captures that more than Moonlight did from 2016 with Barry Jenkins. Obviously the movie that kind of defines or looks at three different segments or chapters of, you know, that individual's life. You know, we have Trevante Rhodes and Mahershala, I can't say his name, Mahershala Ali. I'll just say it real fast so it looks like I said it. But I just think this is an important topic. It's an important thing that we're wrestling with, even maybe more so in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. But it was all kind of set up by that decade. It almost seems like a decade where, you know, we had the 70s, which was, or 60s or 70s, which one kind of in there, where they refer to it as like a sexual revolution type deal. And I feel like there was another one of those types of things going on in that decade where, you know, we were looking at things differently and, you know, accepting or not accepting and including, not including, and wrestling with that. It's a struggle that's ongoing, just like kind of like the race relations that we talked about with Black Klansmen, something we're still struggling with how we deal with that and how we accept or include people and, you know, how much we want to be closed-minded or open-minded, et cetera. So I think Moonlight does a lot of things and it talks about stuff that I think for many decades, if not, you know, throughout most of humankind, people have been afraid to talk about or afraid to admit or afraid to shine a light on it. And I think Moonlight does as good of a job as you can hope for. And so I could not keep it off of my list. So it's at my number seven.
Yeah, I mean, Spock talking about being able to rewatch something. I've only watched this once. It was when I was watching the Best Picture Showcase, and it was like the third movie out of like, you know, five that day. But I really liked it. It was in my top 10 that year. Just couldn't find spots for it. So I'm really happy you found a place for it. Well, you're talking movies that are highly acclaimed, and my number eight is also very highly acclaimed, although rather polarizing, because there's people that'll put it on a list like this, and there's people that'll put it on one of the worst movies ever, and that's Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. And that's often the case with a lot of Terrence Malick films, I feel. A lot of people, and I'm not a huge Terrence Malick fan. I don't like love everything he does. There's some stuff he does I enjoy. I'm kind of 50-50 with him, but Tree of Life I just click with. And I get why people would enjoy it. I actually saw this, again, at AMC Best Picture Showcase, where they show all the best pictures. This was nominated. So I saw a pretty full theater of, you know, general moviegoers. And you could just, and I saw it before that, so it was my second time watching it. And you could just feel the theater just, like, turning because people had no idea what they were watching. It is very, it completely removes any type of, like, linear storytelling. It goes all over the place. It is much more about theme and atmosphere and emotion. I get that doesn't work for everybody, and a lot of people say, like, it's, you know, it's pointless. And, yeah, if you feel that way, I think there's, I can understand that. But it just washed over me. Again, I think the Tree of Life element is pretty fascinating. There are parts of the movie that, like, I'm not hugely into, like, the whole, like, going back in time and basically, like, recreating the world. That might go on for a little bit, but, like, the ties are so high that I can mitigate what doesn't work for me. So, and it did help, I think, watching it multiple times, because the first time I watched it, seeing it in a theater also, I think, helped, even though, like, people were, like, actively booing by the end, which was just interesting, because I've never been in a theater before where, like, people were so angry about what they were watching. But it also just almost added to it as well, but I had to put it in the top 10, so I'll bring it here.
Fair enough. Yeah, this is actually one I haven't seen, so it's one that I have a... There are certain directors that I will avoid, like, specifically, no matter what. And it feels like Terrence Malick should be one of those for me, but I actually just haven't seen hardly any of his films, so I can't necessarily say that he's in that group. The problem with me with Terrence Malick is, yes, he made it, like, a couple films in the 70s, I guess, but, like, he mainly, like, for our lifetime, I mean, he took, like, 20 years off, so, like, 1998 was, like, his re-entrance into the film world. And I remember seeing A Thin Red Line, and it was one of the, I think that's one of the first films that really made me want to, like, dive into movies more and be more, like, do more thoughts, do more discussions, be critical of them and stuff like that. But it was because of how much I could not stand that movie. Like, Thin Red Line was, like, one of the first movies I actively disliked in my lifetime. And so that is the only Terrence Malick film I've seen. So I really need to give him a chance. And I've always thought, like, especially in the last, like, 5-6 years, like, that Tree of Life would be the next one that I would watch on his filmography, just because of how much love so many people give it that I am aware of. And I know that it's popular with a lot of critics. I know, like you said, it's also polarizing. There's a lot of people that dislike it, but I think that will be the next one that I do watch. But yeah, I'm still trying to get over apparently, like, a 25-year grudge against Thin Red Line from him. So that's probably not fair.
I would say if you watch anything, try, like, Badlands, like, one of his first films, because that one's much more straight. It's really good, mostly, but it's also, okay, I think, you realize, okay, he can do more than just shoot people of walking in grass and holding a handbag. He can actually, like, you know, there's Days of Heaven as well that has a lot of that, but, yeah, start with Badlands, and then, like, okay, and then maybe, like, it'd make something like Tree of Life a little bit more palatable, but yeah, I think you would hate it. I'm not.
All right. So I'm going to go from one light to another. So I had Moonlight at number 7, and I'm going to move it over to Spotlight on number 6. I think, just first of all, films that deal with investigative journalism and things like that are really appealing to me just on the surface, but also with what has happened in the last, like, decade and a half, or however long it's been, especially the last, like, 6 or 7 years, with how much journalism has just gone in the toilet. Like, our media is so bad. The people that are the fact that the internet exists and, like, anybody can write an article, like, there is no, like, it seems like there's no journalistic, like, integrity. Half the times there's, like, typos and grammar errors in people's articles. So it's like, it's like an art form that has just gone down so much. So, like, a film like this that kind of really goes into that investigative journalism, I'm not just talking about the written stuff, I'm talking about, you know, reporting, et cetera, where we're actually looking for the truth and we're concerned about the truth, is good in one standpoint. And the other thing that we see in this one is also kind of going back to that same thing, you know, how much we've seen in recent times about crimes of the church or crimes of, you know, different people when it comes to abuse of women, abuse of minors, you know, et cetera, has become a big theme in our lifetime, unfortunately. So I think Spotlight just does a good job highlighting kind of all of those things. And I could watch, you know, it's kind of like the reason I like many documentaries is because of the same type of thing as why I like a movie like Spotlight or different things like that, that kind of really dig into topics like that. So, and it has a ridiculously good cast as well. Like Ruffalo, Mark Ruffalo, another actor who has had a fantastic decade, you know, Michael Keaton's in there, Rachel McAdams. There's so many good performances in that film. And it just, I feel like it's, it might not be the best film of the last decade that we're covering here, but it's, I feel like it's one of the more important ones to just like not forget and not ignore and, you know, realize that that is a thing. And there's been a lot of other films and series and things like that have kind of come out since then that do similar things. So I don't know if this opened the door for people, you know, made people more willing to do that, but I think it's good. The more spotlight we can show on that stuff, no pun intended, the better.
It is interesting. This movie's won Best Picture, and I feel like it doesn't really get talked about. I think because it's so quiet and subdued with its execution, it's like it's easy to overlook, like in the sense of like how good it is. And I think because it like you said, it's putting the story first, literally like the real life story, and not trying to over dramatize it. It's what like people always say they want when it comes to like things based upon real life. So, like, why do they need to make it so over the top? And then you have a movie that does that. And I mean, it gets acclaim, but it doesn't, it seems to be overlooked. And honestly, like I should have probably considered it for my top 10, but I didn't. It would be, I don't think it'd make it, but certainly it'd be neither. Cause like you, I love movies about journalism, the news. And like, like you could argue it's like our generation's All the President's Men, in a way. Yeah. It's very similar in this style, but good pick. My number five, it's something I love movies that just allow us to spend time with people, especially when it's like a subculture I don't know or have no experience with. And that's certainly the case with the Florida Project. And the thing I think about this movie the most when I think about it are just the colors of this movie, right? Because it's about these individuals that live in this motel, literally in the shadow of Disneyland. And it's so like the colors are so vibrant and like exaggerated, and you know, pinks and yellows and things like that. But you realize like underneath, things are not as they seem. I know it got some criticism for being like poverty porn, and I can understand that. But I think there is purpose here to what's being done, and in large part, I think it also works because the performances are really good. A good use of like non-professional actors along with professional actors, starting with Willem Dafoe, who I think this is one of his greatest performances. You know, we know him from being over the top characters like, you know, Green Goblin. Here he's just a normal guy. Like he really tones it down and plays a subdued individual, just this person, this trying to make some sort of sanity in an insane world. But I also think it does have a bit of a message too. I know the ending some people weren't a huge fan of because it does kind of end abruptly. I don't know. I'm indifferent towards it. Everything I love so much up to that. And the more, again, some of those movies that I think about all the time, anytime I think about Disneyland, anything, actually even thinking about hotels, there's so many scenes in this that stick with me. I really love this film so much. So that's why it's my number five.
I'm glad you put that in there too. It didn't make my list, but it's a really good film. Willem Dafoe is amazing in it. And I agree, like these sections of our world that, or societies or things that you can go through life and just not realize that they exist. You know, you can, sometimes we get so blinded by our day to day, like our, you know, our routine, we wake up, we go to work, we spend time with our family, you know, we have our hobbies, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times we don't realize that there's other people living completely different lives, just even within our country, not even talking about worldwide. But, and I think films like this that highlight that are always very intriguing and very interesting, and kind of peel back the curtain again on stuff like that. I think about that and not as good of a film, but things like American Honey. And there's quite a few like different things that came out, films that came out that kind of do that, but this one probably did it best. And I think it's very worthy. I did not mean to do this for my number five, but there's going to be a lot of fives involved. I know I'm like the one that always champions this movie. I don't think I've ever heard anybody else say too much about this. Like, it's never on anybody else's list, but I'll continue to champion it forever because I don't think there's been any topic that has affected more people. Like, it's just a universal thing. Like, there's nobody that hasn't been affected by cancer in our world, unfortunately. And 50-50 to me is just an important film. It came out in 2011, so it might have got lost because it's, you know, very early in the decade. But it's just another one that takes kind of similar to like BlacKkKlansman in a completely different way. I mean, in the fact that it's taking something very serious and it's blending this comedy in it to where it's palatable for someone to watch. But I think this one is just something that people need to watch because I think it really highlights different things that people go through when they're dealing with the fact that either they know somebody that has cancer, they have cancer themselves, or it's, you know, things of that nature. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt is great in it. Seth Rogen's great. We got Anna Kendrick, you know, so not these like Oscar, all these Oscar worthy, like people that you think of when you think of like best actor, outside of maybe Joseph Gordon-Levitt's pretty good, but I think the ensemble just does really well. And like I said, I think if you haven't seen this, I would still urge you to go see this because I just think it's a very well put together movie. And I think it handles that topic that is affecting all of us on a daily, monthly, yearly basis throughout, you know, this time period, and seems to have no end to how long it's going to kind of ravage our society. So 50-50 at number five, Mike would love that, but it was unintentional. So that's my number five pick.
Good choice, yeah. And I love the friendship of, you know, Rogan and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and that it's just, I don't know, something about it. It's just, especially when there's the scene where he finds the book, and not to spoil anything, but like, if you know the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And yeah, mm-hmm. Good choice, definitely.
What's your number four?
My number four, I talked about like how I love movies that kind of give us a window into a world we know nothing of. Number five with Florida Project. Number four is another movie that does that, but a very different type of world in The Rider by Chloe Zhao, who, you know, ends up winning her movie, of course, No Man Land, wins Best Picture. She makes The Eternals. But I think the best thing she did, has done, in my opinion, is The Rider. I didn't include documentaries in my top 10. I thought about it. If I did, it'd probably be a little bit other films. But it's really hard to compare documentaries to new films that aren't, so I didn't. Although you can argue The Rider is basically a documentary. You know, it was started that way. Its lead actor, if you want to say it, wasn't really an actor. He was kind of living this life, and they just made a movie around it, and it works really well. I think that's a big why that has so much authenticity. And there are some scenes that clearly are not designed or not something you could write in a script. I think literally one of my scenes of the decade would be like the scene where he is kind of doing a rodeo thing with someone who's been injured. And, like, you know, it's been paralyzed, but he's kind of, like, mimicking it. It's hard to explain without seeing it. Basically going through it and pretending in this, like, mechanical bull type of thing. And it's just, I don't, as there's, you think about Bittersweet, it is that. Because, you know, obviously this is an individual who can't do what he used to love. But he's kind of getting this moment of just, of it happening. And it's in a movie, but you can't, I think, rate that type of emotion without it being there already. Like, you couldn't, like, if these weren't people who did this type of stuff in real life, it wasn't coming from a place of, you know, if this was actors just playing those parts, I don't think it would work as well. It would come off as maybe a bit cheesy and hokey, but knowing that they're individuals, that, you know, this is not a role for them, this is life, it helps a great deal. And that's the entire movie. Again, I love movies that don't necessarily have a lot of plot. They often click with me. And you'll see that more with other movies on my list. And this is that. Again, there's some story here. It's not that there isn't necessarily, but that's not the point of it, really. You know, it's just, it's these character studies. It's about being part of this world. And I think, you know, it always made me a huge fan of Chloe Zhao. No Man Land, it shares a lot of similarities. I think No Man Land's a good movie. But I think this one is, it's just because it is, you don't maybe have a lead actor, like someone, you know, that is an actual Hollywood actor, and it's just normal people for the most part. It's just that extra special for me. So that's why I have it here at number four.
All right. I have not seen The Rider, so I will add it to my list of things I need to watch.
I think you would really like it, actually. I think, unlike, you know, Tree of Life, which I think you'd hate, I think you might like The Rider. So.
All right. I can balance them each by watching them both. I can balance it out. So. All right. So for my number four, I'm going to go to a film that I'm sure nobody has watched a second time, because it seems to be kind of like a Schindler's List type of film where you see it once and like you're... That I'm good on that, but that doesn't make it any more or less impactful or any less important to me. And I'm going with, I believe, what was at the time might have been my number one for 2015. That has changed since, but I'm going with "Beasts of No Nation," from 2015. Obviously, a highlight of this third world situation, and you know the way they're treating the children, etc., and subscribing them into the army, quote unquote, you can call it. From this, from Cary Joe Fukunaga, and starring Idris Elba. Again, like, this isn't something that you want to watch twice, probably. You see it once and it has a big enough impact on you as well. And I know a lot of people don't like that in their films. You know, we even one of our fellow cinema geeks, like Fridley Scent, like, you know, there's a lot of people out there that aren't trying to get that in their movies. They don't need that necessarily, that realism. They don't want to be depressed by a film or, you know, affected that much in that sort of heavy way. But I gravitate towards those types of films. I don't know why, but like, that's just something that I don't know if I need something like that to bring the emotions out of me that I don't get necessarily if it's not as heavy. But so "Beasts of No Nations" worked really well for me in kind of in a similar way, but completely different to what you're talking about with "Florida Project." You know, shining a light on societies and places in the world that I had no idea existed, at least to that point. Like, yes, you know, I know third world countries exist, and I know, you know, some of this types of stuff, you know, you hear, you read the news headlines and you kind of know, but it's like in America, it's far too easy for us to just turn a blind eye to that. It's like the, you know, the homeless person you see on the side of the road. It's like, you know, it's easy enough to drive past and just not try to think about it. But this movie really shows you exactly what is going on in some of these places, and it's just heartbreaking, heart-wrenching, and important for us to not forget that, you know, that type of stuff still exists in the world, and it's important, and we need to realize it and make efforts to help in any way we can. So I think "Beasts of No Nations" is a super important film, and it's my number four.
Yeah, I think that movie got really not ignored because it was one of the first really big films to come out on Netflix,
True.
and it just because of that, it almost felt like the Academy and stuff like that. I think it actually wasn't, did it not qualify? I forget, but it should have been up for much more than it was. But I think because of this, there was a huge backlash for streaming films, and it's
Right.
not necessarily there anymore. Maybe you could argue there's some, it kind of wishes there that there was, because it maybe it's hurt the movie industry in a bit. But that movie itself, I think it definitely deserved much more recognition than it got, for sure. You're talking about, we mentioned how with The Rider, I think you would like it, and Tree of Life, I think you'd hate it. I know my number three, you're not a fan of, so there's no debate there. But it is Under the Skin, and you're not alone, because I know a lot of people don't like this movie, and I get it. I've actually had many debates regarding this film through many people, and I think it's either of those things that it's like arguing what your favorite color is, because like it's like either it hits you the right way, like either you like blue or you don't. Like it's there's no change, and nothing you could say that's going to change someone's mind. But again, a movie that doesn't necessarily have much of a plot. You just have Scarlett Johansson playing this alien type creature. She goes around, and but again, the presentation. I talk about scenes that like kind of impact me. Mentioned with The Rider, there's the one with them doing the mechanical, you know, the bull thing. With Under the Skin, there's a lot. There's the scene with the person with the deformed face that stuck with me. There's the beach scene or scenes that, especially the one like the final one, which is just disturbing. I love the score with this and how effective it is. It's just a beautiful looking movie, and it's just interesting its approach to science fiction, because with science fiction, we don't think small scale, a little bit more now, but this was a science fiction film with, you know, a shoestring budget that I think didn't necessarily feel that way. But I don't know, it worked on me. I saw it in the theater, and it really grabbed a hold, and I just didn't let go. And there's it's and yeah, I don't know. So it's my number three, and I know you hate it. That's okay. We can get through this.
We're all allowed to like our own
Yeah.
films. I don't need to, I'm not going to try to poop on your pick at all. A lot of people love it. So for my number three, I'm going to keep the heaviness going, I guess. I guess there's a theme there. So this is another one that obviously deals with racial relations, more so in a more of a past racial relations, but just as important today. I'm going with the 2013 film from Steve McQueen, and this is 12 Years a Slave. with Chewie Ejiofor, Fassbender, Cumberbatch. I mean, the cast for this is ridiculous. But I just think there's moments that happen. There's scenes from 12 Years a Slave that will never leave my brain. There's sequences that were shot so well. There was so much thought put into every shot, every camera angle, how long we leave certain things on camera. We talked about this in depth on a review early on in our Cinema Geek Life or something like that. Somewhere back in 2013, we covered this, I think, in depth. So you can always go back and listen to my thoughts there. But 12 Years a Slave, I mean, it was very well acclaimed and received when it came out. It's another one, though, that I feel like kind of like Beasts of No Nation, Schindler's List, those types of films where it's like, yes, people respect it and people like it, but you're not going to see a whole lot of them wanting to talk a whole lot about it, it seems like, because it's like we saw it and we'd want to move past it. But I think it's still rather important and impactful. And I just think it was a masterclass from Steve McQueen and just filmmaking and the acting and everything. Like, it's just almost a masterpiece. I don't know, that's a weird word that people don't like to throw around, but to me it seems like it is. But I don't know, 12 Years a Slave is just something that I will never forget. It was in a very competitive year of film, and it was hard not to have it as my number one for that year. But 12 Years a Slave comes in here at my number three.
Interesting. So now we've gone this far. I don't think we've had any crossover yet. I didn't. Correct. 12 Years a Slave, not on my list, but very... difficult to keep it off. You talk about memorable scenes, that certainly has one, that almost hanging scene. I don't even know how to describe it. That is one. Yes. That's forever etched in my, yeah, that's that is a tough watch for sure. I think maybe I was looking, I kind of avoided the tough watches a little bit in the sense of like movies like that. Maybe that was, I don't know. Maybe if I did this list like a year from now, that would change, but I don't know if we're going to have any crossover. I'm pretty sure we're going to have at least one crossover, but I don't think we'll have a crossover with my number two. Again, continuing my theme of having movies that don't have much of a plot. You know, I am, if anything, I am consistent, but that is the movie that literally took, you know, 10 years to make for my number two in Boyhood. Richard Linklater is my all-time favorite director. It, obviously, you can tell what I like is kind of the style he makes movies in, like movies that are just kind of about people. You obviously have the Before trilogy. I thought really hard about putting Before Midnight on this list. It's hard too, because like that movie is so related within that trilogy, it felt like almost cheating in a bit. But I went with Boyhood, and there's a moment in this I think that kind of encapsulates not only like what I love about this movie, but like films like this in general. And it's just Ethan Hawke having a conversation with his son about like the, you know, talking about, you know, how much of real life we would think was fantasy if we looked for an edited perspective, talking about like blue whales and back whales, and like what if you were to describe those, there's aspects of them that you would think are fanatical or out there and crazy, but they're real life, but we don't think of it that way. And I think that's a lot of what this movie is. It's just aspects of real life and just trying to find the fascination in those. Like, you know, it's small snippets of you know, this person literally growing up, and I know some people called it was like a gimmick, and it is a gimmick, but I think it's a gimmick that's executed really well with great performances. I think it's Ethan Hawke's greatest performance, even with the Before films, because of what he's asked to do here. I love how he kind of pops in and pops out. There's a great conversation about Star Wars and getting more movies well before that was even a thing that was possible. But yeah, again, like it doesn't try to, it's got to be difficult to even think of logistics of making a something like this. Like, how do you do it? Where are you going with it? But I think someone like Richard Linklater can make it work, but I think he's never trying to force something that's not there. Patricia Arquette as well, I think she won an Oscar for this. She was really good. I know there maybe the one of her final scenes maybe goes a bit too much when it comes to trying to connect the dots with the one place where maybe it tries to force a narrative that didn't need to be there. But in general, you know, I just really dug this movie, and that's why it's my number two.
Not just you call it the gimmick, but not just like the logistics of actually making that happen, but also the risk. Like, yeah, there was a huge risk in everybody still being around, everybody still being willing, you know, nobody had you know, there was a lot of risk. So it wasn't just like something you're just doing willy-nilly. Like it took a lot of time. It took a lot of thought. It took a lot of dedication from a lot of different people to pull that all off and make it seem seamless. And I think they were very successful in doing that. So for my number two, it's just a personal favorite of mine. There's going to be obviously a theme for the rest of my list, my number two and my number one. It's going to revolve around technology, because I think there's almost nothing in that decade that has been more prevalent in our society than the advancement of technology and the way it has affected life, the way it has affected communication, people's social norms, people's ability to socialize with people, you know, things of that nature. And it's seeming like it's even going to become more important, obviously, as technology does throughout, you know, the future years, etc. So I'm going with a personal favorite of mine. This is from 2015, the film that I had above Beast of No Nations that year, which would be Alex Garland's Ex Machina, with Oscar Isaac, Alicia Vikander, and Domhnall Gleeson. A great performance from Oscar Isaac, a great decade from Oscar Isaac. Alicia Vikander is probably my favorite actress of the decade as well. And I just think this movie is important. It's fascinating. It's intriguing. It's everything I want in a science fiction, technology-based film. And you got, I know everybody wants to like talk about the dance scene and whatnot for Oscar Isaac, but like that is just like so like minor when it comes to the reasons why I like Ex Machina. And this is a film that I do want to watch again. Like, it's not, you know, I've given you like 12 Years a Slave and Beast of No Nation and all these things that you probably don't want to watch. Like, Ex Machina is something that I personally would not mind rewatching a few more times, because I just think it's that good. And that's why I have it all the way up here at my number two.
It was interesting when you were saying, you know, about technology. I'm like, oh, here, number two going to be my number one, because my number one very much about technology. I think we might have the same number one. I don't know. I think we'll see, but I won't be beat around the bush any longer. I do like Ex Machina, but my number one, and I don't think it's a surprise, because when we did our top 100, this was my number 10. It's Spike Jonze's Her. I love this movie so much. It is. I remember I actually saw this. I got a free screening for something. It was like, I don't know, online or whatever. And I was just like, I saw it a little bit beforehand, and I couldn't wait for people to see it so I could talk about it, because there's just so much about this movie to discuss. Obviously you can't do it here, but you know, people, you know, this idea of Joaquin Phoenix character falling in love with his phone, you know, he thinks it's going to be this commentary on our addiction to technology, and that's in there, but it's really just one small bit of so much else I love about this movie. And starting with the fact that you have this so much chemistry between Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson, which is hilarious, because you know, when Joaquin Phoenix performed this, he was performing with another actress. Scarlett Johansson came back in and kind of redid those lines. And you can never tell. Like and I think it also helps enhance the story itself, knowing that in a way. Joaquin Phoenix is, you know, again, talking about actors of the decade, he certainly is up there. Really, this, you know, he's playing crazy characters here. More of a kind of this guy, you know, living his life. I love the world that's built here. And, you know, this is obviously the future, but it doesn't like make a big deal about it being the future, just some subtle changes of like high-waisted pants. I love the cinematography here. There's so many great moments. There's so much I love about her. I think it also gets into just the authenticity of relationships, long distance relationships. And it's, you know, it's crazy that this story about someone falling in love with their phone would be my movie of the decade, but I think it's fitting for the decade that we're in, considering I'm doing this podcast on my phone right now. So this shows you where we come from. But yeah, this was one that I have rewatched obviously multiple times. It has such a huge personal impact on me. It's a movie that made me realize why I love films. A lot of my movies don't necessarily have a lot of plot. This does much more so, but just, I don't know. I guess I'll just shut up because I don't know what your number one is.
My number one's Her as well. So obviously you probably could see that the technology theme will continue. Can we convince Spike Jonze to stop doing stuff with the Jackass like franchise and tries to do other films again? Like nothing against Jackass, but like that's all he's done since Her is Jackass stuff. Like, come on, man. But yeah, Joaquin Phoenix, like you said, is probably would be like, without actually doing the the work of going through the actual decade to like find out who the best actor was, like Joaquin Phoenix would be like my early pick. Like I would say like he's got to be number one, two, or three somewhere in there. Like Fassbender maybe up there too, but Joaquin Phoenix is way up there. And I like everything you said, like this is such an important film in the same reasons that I'm talking about Ex Machina apply to this as well, as far as the impact technology has and the relationship that we have with technology and how, where that can go and like the void that is left in our life when we become the society that is just work and then going home to yourself and like the longing that you have to not be alone and where you can find that connection and where you can find that relationship. And you know, the human race is meant to be connected to things and to have relationships. And, you know, when there's people not involved, if technology takes that place and kind of all the different things that that kind of unpacks as you watch that is fascinating to watch. And I think Joaquin Phoenix is amazing. Scarlett Johansson, I know some people try to like say bad things about her performance in that. I think it's great. And I think those two together, even if they weren't knowingly acting, you know, against each other, it still works so well. And I think her is one of the most important films, one of the most fascinating films that I've ever seen. So it easily was my pick for the number one for this last decade as well, just like you. So we didn't have a single crossover, but we share until we got to number one. So that's interesting. So I guess if you're going to agree on something, it might as well be number one, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, so we had, you know, top tens, nine different films, and then number one. So obviously you can tell what our pick of the decade would be. So there you go.
Right. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time maybe just talking about some films. I know we've mentioned some in passing as far as ones that just didn't quite make our list, but we had kind of highlighted too that, you know, that number 10 was really hard. There was, you know, three or four films that didn't quite make it. I mean, if you want to rattle off your 10 that didn't, or however many you want to talk about, any films that you'd like to highlight that didn't quite make your list?
Sure. I had Mother in there originally at number 10, but I guess technically it's a 2009 movie, so I was like, I don't know if it would qualify. Because I saw it in 2010 for the first time, so I was hesitant. I mentioned I didn't include documentaries. If I did, the movie Buck from 2011 would have been there. Also, Let the Fire Burn, two of my favorite documentaries of the year. The Social Network is really close to making my list. Startup, a movie you know, probably better known, the company with the director of Hell or High Water, who probably got much more recognition for that. But I love Startup. I love both of those movies, but Startup just has so much intensity. The Master was up there. You mentioned Mad Max. Drive, Before Midnight. Parasite was really close. I'm just thinking of others. I like Father, Like Son. I saw Devil, The Raid. Talking of great action movies. Also I had some love for Ridley Scott. The Martian is one of my favorite movies. It was up there in my top 25. And Arrival and A Separation came really close as well. So excellent. I guess that was like 15 movies that came really close to my top 10.
So. I'm the same way. So I had The Master up there as well, that was fighting for that last spot, along with The Social Network and Parasite. And then ones that also were pretty close, I had Manchester by the Sea, The Martian, like you talked about, Inception. I really had a soft spot for Monster Calls for some more personal reasons. I even thought A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood from Mariel Heller was worth talking about. I have a personal affinity for Les Mis, even though a lot of people hate that film, that version of it. The Hunt from Thomas Vinterberg from 2012-ish, thought that's an important film and it should be seen by more people. Let's see if there was anything else. I had Annihilation 2, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Irishman, Hell or High Water, Arrival. So a lot of them. Oh, and What We Do in the Shadows. I should throw that in there too. I think it was on our top list for comedies. So those were some of the ones. What else I found interesting, maybe just kind of a closing commentary here. Is there a year that really stands out on your list? I don't know if you highlighted the years, but for me, it was like there were some years that seemed rather not weak necessarily, but I don't have hardly any representation from like 2017, and Whiplash is the only one I have from 2014 in my like top 25, 30 films, but I have so many from a couple of these other years, like 2013 for me with Her, The Hunt kind of came out in 2013, 12 Years a Slave. I know you had a couple picks on yours that weren't on mine that are also from 2013. Yeah. Your number 10 and I believe your number 8 were both from 2013. But 2015, Ex Machina, Beasts of No Nation, Spotlight, Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian, Room, What We Do in the Shadows, technically in the U.S., like, I don't know if there's a year for me that's better than 2015 in that decade. Did you have any years that really stood out to you?
2013 was probably up there. Blue Ruin, The Rider, or no, that's 2017. Her, Under the Skin, also 2013. 2017, The Rider, Florida Project, both up there for me. So, yeah, those, it's pretty spread out outside of that. Like, I do have some. I don't have any. Well, I don't have anything from 2020 because that's a different decade, so that'll explain that. but yeah, it's outside of the 2013 is definitely the list, the year that pops up the most. And then it gets obviously a little bit funky when it comes to like foreign films.
Release dates.
Yeah, because like The Red Turtle, I think it's 2016, but I think it's 2017 in the U.S. So that's where it gets
right.
And then you have festival dates and whatnot. So like,
yeah,
it's hard to. But yeah, I mean, I just looking at like my top of film list, but 2013, like four of those movies made my top five, or four of those movies made my top 10. So I really liked movies that year. So, and that's when we were probably, yeah. And I think that was like the year
off, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So I was watching much, I was also watching much more movies in the first 5 years of the decade than the second half. You know, kids will do right. That too. So.
Yep, yep. And I mean, my top four is two films from 2013 and two films from 2015. So yeah. I think those 2 years are just huge in the decade if it were to come to that. So that's our top 10 picks of our films from the last decade. And now that we're, you know, 3 years into the next decade, we have some, or 4 years, I guess, and into the next decade, if you count 2020, I guess you have to. But it's just an interesting, it's going to be a completely different like dynamic when it comes to this, because we had the whole COVID situation and we had all of this different weirdness going on at the beginning of this next decade. So it's going to be interesting once this one gets closer. I'm sure we'll do like a half decade here in you know, another year or so. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Dan, anything else that you'd like to highlight as far as how people can reach out, keep in touch with you or what you're doing online?
Sure. You can find all my stuff. I'm Comic Concierge pretty much everywhere. TikTok, Instagram is what I use the most, but also on Twitter. Threads, which I haven't used, I think, since I signed up. So there's that as well. So, but yeah, that's where you can find me.
You can stay tuned with all things related to the network by searching out Geekcast Radio Network. They have Facebook. They have whatever we're calling Twitter X account. They have a website that you can go to and stay in tune with all the different geeky related things. Science fiction, Transformers, comics, everything that they highlight over there. For myself, you can search out the YouTube channel Geek Showcase to keep up with anything that I'm doing on there. I'm due to do a new video soon. I think it's going to be one of the Star Trek cast rankings because I already have done my top 10 animated rats in kind of conjunction with the release of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. So I was going to do Turtles too. I just don't know if I'll get to it quite yet or not. So you can keep all that stuff. I have a... Go ahead.
Well, I love the rat movie. That rat video. I was like, there's so many rats. I did not know that there was that many fictional rats, but I was impressed.
So. And they're usually bad guys, and they usually die. So I guess that's a thing. So. So that does it for this episode of the Cinema Geeks. You can tune in next time where we're going to cover one more film from Teenage Mutant Turtles before we get to the feature film release from 2023. So until then, check us out next time for another episode of the Cinema Geeks.